electricity from the dubious, rickety escalators. I even remember the smell of the urinal pucks in the men's room. And by the way, who takes a dump at a hockey game? But people definitely did, believe me. I guess it was a case of dump and chase, but again, I digress. Hockey, for me, is home. When we all heard that the series was going to happen, my brothers and I, like the rest of the country, thought it was going to be a cakewalk for Canada. We had seen the hilarious training films of the Soviets on Hockey Night in Canada, which showed them practicing with oversized weighted sticks and parachutes on their backs when they ran suicide drills. It was the typical Soviet medicine ball-throwing exhibition of science and strength crap. Think Rocky IV. My God, we were smug. We even felt a little bad for them because they had drab CCCP uniforms and weird Yofa helmets that made them look like evil robots. Ironically, Canada's greatest player, Wayne Gretzky, would later wear a Yofa helmet. My brothers and I saw Game 1 in 80-degree weather on a color television in the Better Living Center building at the Canadian National Exhibition. On the way to the CNE, we saw a billboard for a Canadian vodka company called McGuinness Vodka. It read, in reference to the Soviets, "If they can play hockey, we can make vodka." This was going to be funny. By the end of Game 1, which Canada lost 7-3, it wasn't at all funny. A week later, in a stroke of advertising brilliance, McGuinness Vodka had changed its billboard by crossing out the "if" so that it now read, "They can play hockey, we can make vodka." And boy, could they play hockey. They were great skaters, fit, disciplined, and they had weird Harlem Globetrotter-type plays where they literally skated in circles around the Canadian team, who looked hungover. And worst of all, those Ruskies could stick handle. Somehow, stick handling felt like a Canadian skill. How dare they? We won Game 2. We tied Game 3. A tie, first of all. This series was so not designed by Americans. And in Vancouver, we lost Game 4, 5-3. Some fans in the Pacific Coliseum booed Team Canada off the ice. I, however, was in Toronto booing those Vancouver fans. This brings us to moment number one, the speech. Phil Esposito, an alternate captain of Team Canada, gave the most rousing post-game speech on nationwide TV. Phil Esposito said, "Every one of us guys, 35 guys that came out and played for Team Canada, we did it because we love our country, and not for any other reason, no other reason. They can throw the money, you know, for the pension fund out the window. They can throw anything they want out the window. We came because we love Canada. And even though we play in the United States and we earn money in the United States, Canada is still our home. And that's the only reason we come. And I don't think it's fair that we should be booed." Esposito's speech made me proud to be Canadian. And I couldn't help but think that a speech like that would never have happened before 1967. The Next Great Nation initiative was working. Game 5 was in Russia, and Canada lost 5-4. The series was 3-1 in favor of the Soviet Union. There was one tie. This leads me to moment number two, the chant, which happened in Game 6. There were 3,000 Canadian fans who had traveled to Moscow, and the Soviets had seated them all together. The Soviet Union, of course, was a country in a permanent state of the War Measures Act. In a display of defiance and patriotism, the Canadian fans came up with a chant. "Nyet, nyet, Soviet, da, da, Canada." They could have been thrown in jail for this. I still can't get "nyet, nyet, Soviet, da, da, Canada" out of my head, and that was 44 years ago. Canada eked out its first win in Russia, bringing the series to 3-2, still in favor of the USSR, with two games remaining. In Game 7, Canada won 4-3, evening up the series. It all came down to Game 8. I was 9 years old, school was back in session, and just like when the Americans landed on the moon, we were all taken to the gym to watch the game on three Canadian-made Electrohome televisions that were on these tall, wheeled stands. The gym was packed. We were given little Canadian flags. All of us kids were amped like we had had 10 cherry blossom chocolate bars and a six-pack of Dominion Cola. Soviets up, 1-0. Esposito ties, 1-1. First period ends, 2-2. Soviets up 5-3 by the end of the second period. Esposito saves a goal and then goes on to score to make it 5-4 for Russia. Yvonne, the roadrunner Cornwaye, scores to tie it at 5. And this brings us to moment number 3, the goal. As Paul Henderson puts it, I jumped on the ice and rushed straight for the net. I had this strange feeling that I could score the winning goal. The Canadians advanced, and with 34 seconds left, the great Canadian hockey announcer Foster Hewitt described it as follows. Cornwaye has it on the wing. Here's a shot. Henderson made a wild stab for it and fell. Here's another shot right in front. They score! Henderson has scored for Canada! In the gym, coats went flying. Henderson, who played for the Toronto Maple Leafs, had scored the winning goal. Canada had beaten the Soviet Union. Canada had taken on the mighty Russian bear by itself and won. Teachers were crying and hugging. Parents spontaneously came to pick up their children. I was the last to leave the gym, and as the AV squad closed the metal doors and the Electrohome televisions to put them away in the AV closet, I sat on my coat by myself and prayed, "Please, God, never let me forget this moment." If we could beat the Soviets, we could do anything. We were number one, no more number two. There was no going back. Maybe we were already the next great nation. But alas, there was more building to come. Specifically, the world's tallest building, the CN Tower. In 1973, the Canadian National Railway, or CN, began building a tower on its property in downtown Toronto for the purpose of transmitting radio and TV signals. It was to be the world's tallest building, but in typical fashion, Canadians feel compelled to describe it more accurately as the world's tallest freestanding structure. It was completed in 1976, and I remember watching with great pride as a Sikorsky lift helicopter put the last piece of the tower in place. My parents bought souvenir CN Tower whiskey. The whiskey was polished off right away, but we kept the bottle. I still have it. In the shadow of the new CN Tower, across the street from where John Lennon had performed at the 1969 Rock and Roll Revival Festival, there was a dance studio called the Roland & Romain School of Dance. It was run by the choreographers of a Canadian TV variety show called The Pig and Whistle, which was set in a mock English pub and featured English-oriented entertainment. The dancers did the sort of cheeky-chappy dancing you would see in Mary Poppins. I told my parents that's what I wanted to do for a living, and they, to their credit, enrolled me in the Roland and Romaine School of Dance. I took tap dancing lessons there. My ever-supportive brothers decided, much to my horror, that my new nickname should become Twinkle Toes. I owe a debt of gratitude to the nickname because it was how I learned to fist fight. One day I got a call from Romaine. I never really knew her last name. A company producing a television commercial was looking for child dancers. They asked if I wanted to audition. I said yes, and to my surprise, I got hired. It was a commercial set in the 1950s, and a young family breaks in to dance. I was the son. I had a sister, a father, and a mother who was played by Gilda Radner. Gilda had not yet been hired for Saturday Night Live. In fact, Saturday Night Live didn't exist yet. It was a 4-day shoot, and I, like every other human being who met her, fell in love with Gilda. And on the last day of the shoot, we said our goodbyes in the parking lot. I cried like a baby. My whole family came to pick me up, and upon seeing me crying, my brothers gave me a new nickname to replace Twinkle Toes. I was hereby called Sucky Baby, because of the emotion I had displayed upon my cruel separation from Ms. Gilda Radner, who became known in my house as your girlfriend. I was Sucky Baby for 10 years. Even in my 20s, if I displayed any intellectual precociousness, I was immediately brought down to earth with, "Wow, that's really smart, Sucky Baby." I went on to do about 17 commercials and several movies made for TV, Thanks, CanCon. And in the process, I ended up working with Bruno Gerussi, Lee Remick, and Lois Maxwell, who played Moneypenny in the James Bond movies. One day in 1975, I came home and my brother said to me, "Hey, sucky baby, your girlfriend, Gilda Radner, is going to be on this stupid show on Saturday. It's a live comedy show that doesn't even have a name. It's just called Saturday Night." That week, Saturday came, and we gathered around the television. Our minds were blown. This was a show unlike any other show we'd ever seen. It was rock and roll. It was dangerous. It was created by a Canadian, Lorne Michaels. I'd been a fan of Lorne since 1970 when I saw him on his CBC comedy show with Hart Pomerantz, The Hart and Lorne Terrific Hour. Thanks again, CanCon. Gilda entered one of the sketches and I fell in love with her all over again. As the cast gathered on stage for the closing credits, a feeling came over me, and, in an outrageous act of unearned confidence, I turned to my brothers and said, "I'm going to be on that show one day." My brothers were immediately encouraging. "Yeah, right, dream on, sucky baby." Here was the coolest show on American TV, created by a Canadian, co-starring Dan Aykroyd. These are the fruits of the dreaded big government. In fact, a case could be made that American big government also played a hand in the creation of Saturday Night Live. SNL owes as much to the CBC as it does to FDR and the WPA. And here's the link. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, under the New Deal, created the Works Progress Administration, WPA, which was a make-work project during the Depression. The WPA hired a dramatist, Viola Spolin, to teach immigrant children English through the use of improvisational theater games. Viola Spolin's son, Paul Sills, brought these improv games to Chicago in the 1950s, and he, with David Shepard, formed the improv sketch troupe, the Compass Players. Enter Mike Nichols, Elaine May, and Bernie Solins, and thus the Second City Theater Company was born. The Second City franchised to Toronto, where a young Lorne Michaels met Gilda Radner, Dan Aykroyd, and, in Chicago, John Belushi and Bill Murray. They formed the nucleus of the Not Ready for Primetime Players, and Saturday Night Live was born. No FDR, no SNL. The next great nation era reached its climax at the 1976 Montreal Olympics. It was the first Olympics after the Munich Massacre, and the flamboyant mayor of Montreal, Jean Drapeau, had a lot riding on its success. Trouble began to brew before the games even started, when construction fell behind schedule and ran way over budget, despite Mayor Drapeau's overconfidence in 1970 when he declared, "The Olympics can no more have a deficit than a man can have a baby." The games started on schedule, though there were construction problems throughout, and thankfully, there was no bloodshed. But Canada performed miserably, becoming the only host country in the history of the Olympics not to earn a gold medal. In fact, when Canadian broadcasters changed the film that ran alongside the national anthem at the end of the broadcast day, they included a clip of the 1976 Montreal Olympics, Canadian high jumper Greg Joy successfully clearing the bar. What's not made clear in the footage is that Greg Joy only won a silver medal. Imagine the Americans putting a silver medal winner in a montage like this. And, in an ironic twist, Greg Joy was actually born in the States. The 1976 Montreal Olympics racked up a $1 billion debt that took 30 years to pay off. In 1977, Mayor Drapeau gave birth to a beautiful baby boy. For Canada, 1976 was a foreboding year after what had felt like a fantastic role since Expo 67. We'd had the Centennial, Trudeau, John Lennon, CanCon, the 72 Summit Series, a flourishing culture, and national pride was at an all-time high. But had the wave crested? We had come so close. Would Canada ever get a mission statement? Would Canada ever get an identity? Chapter 4, A Canadian Adulthood. In the summer of 1982, I was 19, and I had just been hired by the Second City Theater Company. I moved out of my family's home in Scarborough and got my first downtown apartment, which was in a rundown West End Toronto neighborhood called Parkdale. I had a room in a giant Victorian mansion filled with conceptual artists. My brother Paul lived there as well, and he introduced me to a world of artists and artistic sensibilities and the music of Brian Eno and the Talking Heads. The artists in this house all had Canada Council art grants, and I would hardly say they were living in the lap of luxury. It was subsistence living, but it was cool. Each day, I would take the streetcar all the way to the center of town. At Queen and Yonge, I would go into the Eaton's department store, and for good luck, I would rub the toe of the statue of Timothy Eaton, the store's founder. His toe was brightly polished from other people rubbing it, and it stuck out over the plinth that the statue stood on, as if inviting you to rub it. I needed luck, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. My fellow performers in the Second City Touring Company were seasoned veterans. Each of them was insanely talented. The first part of the show was scripted, usually tried-and-true sketches from the vaults of Second City in Toronto and Chicago. Performers at Second City tended to fall under various archetypes. The big guy, John Candy, Chris Farley. The smart guy, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd. The Irish girl, Catherine O'Hara, Tina Fey, though she's not Irish. The Jewish girl, Elaine May, Gilda Radner. And then my archetype, the small guy with lots of energy. Martin Short was my patron saint. The second part of the show, the improv set, is where I shone. I wasn't very strong with scripted material, and certainly not scripted material that I wasn't connected to. At that time, my friend Dave Foley was doing brilliant, almost experimental sketch comedy with the kids in the hall. They were great improvisers, but they didn't care much for the form. Dave Foley would often say, "Improv could do with a rewrite." Their material was personal, fresh, and thrilling. They were doing what I wanted to do, but I was very grateful to be in Second City, and my mind was blown that being a professional actor was my quote-unquote job. We mostly toured the hinterlands around Toronto, and in the summers, there was a permanent gig at a lodge near Algonquin Park, a provincial park in northern Ontario, roughly a quarter of the size of Belgium. This was the beginning of my Hamburg period. Second City was kind enough to let me be not very good for a long time. My fellow performers taught me well. Some of them took me under their wing because I was a chick that had just left the nest, not yet skilled enough to fly. Amongst the many gifts I received from the Second City Touring Company was the opportunity to see the rest of Canada. Until then, other than Quebec, I hadn't seen much of the country. I remember one particularly eventful cross-Canada tour. We went from Newfoundland on the east coast to Vancouver on the west coast, 4,000 miles. Newfoundland was beautiful, and my mind was blown by the Newfie accent, so much so that, after the show in St. John's, I went to a nightclub and pretended I was Scottish for a whole evening, ashamed at how boring my Toronto accent was compared to the Newfie brogue. The next show was in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I love Halifax. I had the best salmon tartare and Caesar salad of my life at one of those 18th century restaurants down by the beautiful harbor. For a city of its size, it always feels like it has as much nightlife as New York. I had one of my best shows of the tour in Halifax. It was also, however, the spookiest show. After the scripted portion, I came out to introduce the improv set. The crowd was electric, but as I was on stage explaining something, a deep, resonant, booming voice from the crowd said, "You have wonderful energy, Michael." The voice sounded like Vincent Price. It was otherworldly. I wasn't famous, so I don't know how, quote-unquote, the voice knew my name. I said, "Wow, we have a contingency from Hades here this evening." The voice continued, "You really do have great energy, Michael." This time, the audience did a collective, "Ooh, he was scary." I finished the show, and I was backstage talking to a couple of lovely ladies, when the voice came backstage. It was attached to a man in his 40s, 6'5", black ringlets of long, flowing hair, heavy black eye makeup, and black clothing. "You really do have wonderful energy, Michael," he said in his booming voice. The members of my cast scattered. The well-wishers backstage froze in their tracks. I said nervously, "Thank you." He continued, "You know, Halifax is one of 7 spots around the world that collects energy."
"Oh, yeah?"
"So we are particularly attuned to those that possess energy."
"Right on."
At that moment, I noticed a large pendant around his neck. It was an inverted pentagram, the upside-down star shape favored by devil worshippers. My heart stopped.
I'll leave you now, Michael. Blessed be, Michael. Blessed be.
He didn't walk out of the room so much as hover backwards. People started to genuflect. Strangers came up to me wondering if I was okay. Of course,
blessed be, Michael,
became my newest catchphrase with the rest of the cast. In Thunder Bay, Ontario, the cast conspired to call my room at 3 o'clock in the morning and every hour afterwards, using devil voices saying,
could I speak to Michael, please? I need some of his energy.
I would get handwritten messages slid under the door by hotel staff that just said,
you have a call from Blessed Be.
Thunder Bay is the home of Paul Schaefer, best known as the band leader on David Letterman's talk show. I spent a day taking Polaroids of Thunder Bay. I went to the Finnish neighborhood where I had a sauna and the Finnish equivalent of a smorgasbord. In the bay is a magical island called the Sleeping Giant, which looks exactly like a sleeping giant. We then went on to Winnipeg. Winnipeg had more hipsters per capita than any other city in Canada. Home of the world-famous Royal Winnipeg Ballet, government-subsidized, the quote-unquote Soho of Winnipeg was an unexpected bohemian delight. Of course, I ate pierogies. It's the pierogi capital of Canada. I also experienced the corner of Portage in Maine, literally the coldest corner in Canada that isn't in the Arctic. Cold, impervious to the warming effects of several dozen pierogies and half a bottle of vodka. Next, we drove through Saskatchewan, Big Sky Country, the flattest place I have ever been. If you stand on a 5-step platform, you can see an extra mile. They had to put bends in the road so that people wouldn't fall asleep driving at night. We played a town in Saskatchewan called Swift Current, which the locals call Speedy Creek. After the show, I went to a native Canadian bar whose house band was called the FBI's, which, upon inquiry, was revealed to stand for the fucking big Indians. My castmate, though in his 30s, was still a juvenile delinquent. He started to get mouthy and tried to hook me into a fight with the FBI's. I apologized for my asshole Toronto friend, which they accepted. I went outside to get some air. My castmate was given the bum's rush by a native Canadian who, I swear, was 7'5". My castmate proceeded to steal a cab and implored me to get in, because that would be our ride home. He leaned on the horn, causing the entire bar to empty, including the owner of the taxi. The castmate hit the gas and left me with these angry locals. The look on my face saved my life, because the entire town burst into spontaneous laughter. They called the cops and invited me in for one more drink and a grilled cheese sandwich. The car was retrieved, and the cab driver brought me home. We went to Regina, Saskatchewan's capital, and had a great show. Americans never believe that there's a town called Regina. In fact, in the show, we had a word association scene which went as follows. Mother, father. Love, hate. Vagina, Saskatchewan. That's the sketch, people. That's it. And it killed, night after night. And then, in the words of the Guess Who, we went running back to Saskatoon, which, as the name would suggest, is in Saskatchewan. We were 2 days in Saskatoon. On the free night, I decided to check out the University of Saskatchewan's theater department's year-end production of the restoration comedy, The Country Wife. This beautiful theater at the University of Saskatchewan was packed with Saskatonians. The snobby Torontonian me had low expectations. It was Saskatoon, after all. The Sticks. Lo and behold, this little university in the middle of Canada knocked it out of the park. The acting was thrilling, the stagecraft was brilliant, the lighting was artful, student musicians played authentic Baroque music live on stage, and it was funny. It was one of the greatest nights of theater in my life. Thank you, Canadian government. Money well spent. That night, I treated myself by staying at the Bessborough Hotel on the Saskatchewan River in downtown Saskatoon. The Bessborough is one of the Canadian railway hotels, huge, majestic, castle-like, with triangular copper roofs, like the Canadian Parliament buildings in Ottawa, pure Canadiana, one of the nicest hotels I've ever stayed at. In Calgary, we had another fantastic show, and afterwards I wanted to go out to experience one of the famous wild bars on Calgary's Electric Avenue. But I was starving, so I went back to the hotel diner on the ground floor. As I took a seat at the counter, I felt a pair of eyes on me. It was a beautiful lady staring at me with such intensity that a sheen of sweat broke out over my forehead. I was with two other cast members who assured me that, due to the bizarre attention I was receiving, I was definitely going to get lucky here in Calgary. She approached. She was stunning. She was French-Canadian and said to me,
"Allô, Michel. I love the show."
"Oh, thank you." In my head, I screamed, "How does she know my name?"
"You know, Michel, you have wonderful energy."
She spread open her vest, which I hoped might be so that she could show me her ample cleavage. But instead, she revealed a pendant, a pentagram, just like that of the voice in Halifax. My two cast members got up and ran out of the diner, screaming, "Too much evil! Too much evil!" Then the beautiful French-Canadian Satanist said,
"I don't think they could handle your energy."
She put her hand on my thigh, which I would later claim left a scorch mark.
"Do you want to go to another club? I know a great club where you'll feel welcome."
I lied, and I told her that I was a gratefully recovering alcoholic, and that, should I have one more drink, I would need yet another liver transplant. She laughed and, as she hit the cold Calgary air, turned back and said to me,
"Blessed be, Michel, blessed be."
I got no sleep. The next night was Lethbridge, Alberta. We drove past the Hoodoos, a unique geological formation of wind-worn rocks that form mushroom-capped columns of stone that create the illusion of a vast army of, quote-unquote, rock people. I'm not talking about the Kiss Army. I had barely heard of Lethbridge, and I was struck by the variety of terrain in my home and native land. And then we drove through the Crow's Nest Pass in the Canadian Rockies. The Canadian Rockies are the most beautiful place on the planet Earth. Truly magical, truly virginal, almost a joke. We got to Nelson, British Columbia, a pristine town nestled amongst breathtaking mountains, brilliantly preserved from its heyday of the Silver Rush. Of course, Canada had a second Silver Rush in 1976 at the Montreal Olympics. We played the Art College in Nelson. The audience was filled with art students, and after the show I got drunk and started to dance with one of the art tarts at the school. She was older than me and very forward, which, because I was shy, was a godsend. It was a humid dance floor at the after-show party. Before the tour, I had bought a new leather jacket. The art tart whispered in my ear seductively, "Do I smell leather?" I replied earnestly, "Sorry, it's new." She found my innocence adorable and whispered, "Do I smell handcuffs?" I immediately spit out, "No, you do not smell handcuffs." Then she said,
"Pity, I'm going to get us a drink."
She went across the room to her 6'5" biker boyfriend, and from afar I could see that she was asking him for money to buy me a drink. The biker boyfriend shot me a dagger, so I took off into the next room and hid. Consequently, I missed the troop van back to the hotel, which was 2 miles away. I looked in my wallet. I had 75 cents. I was going to have to hoof it. Drunk as a lord, I began to stumble home along the wooded, unlit highway. About a mile in, completely alone, I heard a rustling behind me, and I saw the reflective glow of a wild animal's eye. It was a wolf. My heart started to pound. Then there were 12 wolves. I started to lightly drunk jog toward the safety of the hotel lights in the distance. All at once, the wolf pack's ears shot up and their nostrils flared, presumably because they too could smell leather. Then they started to jog after me with the princely gait of an accomplished predator. Seeing this, I started to run my fastest. And because of the 11-plus Molson beer in me, I was now vomitous, or as we say in Scarborough, I had a honk on deck. I started to whimper. So this was how I was going to die, torn apart by a pack of wolves in the wilds of British Columbia. At least it would be a Canadian death. Miraculously, a car with one headlight approached from the other direction. As if out of a 1950s sci-fi movie, I ran to the middle of the road, frantically waving my hands to flag down the car. Mercifully, the one headlighted car stopped and let me in. To my horror, the driver had one eye. One headlight, one eye. Now I was really freaked out. Were they his wolves? Is this how he gets his prey? The conspiracy, of course, would have been confirmed had the wolves only had one eye. He pulled a U-turn to take me to my hotel. Behind us, I saw the faces of disappointed wolves. My cycloptic savior asked me, "Are you from Toronto?" I said, "Yeah, how did you know?" He said, "Only a dipshit from Toronto would walk along this road." As we arrived at the hotel, the troupe was already loading the touring van to head to the next show. I curled up in the back with the costumes, made myself a little nest, and slept for 8 hours. I woke up in Vancouver. We did a show that night. It was a great house, and as is the case when you're 20, I was up for going out again. The stage manager of the theater recommended a bar downtown. Mysteriously, he insisted that the bar was perfect for me. I wasn't sure if he thought I was gay or a socialist or into karaoke, but I went to this quote-unquote perfect-for-me bar with a couple of castmates. The address took us to an unmarked building with a set of stairs leading down to a basement bar door, behind which we could hear muffled yet slightly sinister music. One cast member said, "Fuck it, Myers, I'm not going in there," and left for the hotel. I opened the door. On the back wall of the bar was a giant pentagram. The remaining cast members ran away, again shouting, "Too much evil!" On the bar itself was a goat's head. The band was called the 666s. I'm guessing they were the house band of the Beast. I stayed and had a drink. I don't know what possessed me. I have fond feelings for Vancouver. I got over my grudge about them booing Team Canada during the 72 Summit Series once I remembered that Vancouver was the home of Greenpeace. Good work, Vancouver. Good work, Greenpeace. You do us proud. Vancouver is stunning. Those two beautiful peaks, the Lions, reminded me of Bruce Coburn's "Wondering Where the Lions Are." I love that song, especially his reference to the sweet smell of the fir trees, which I had smelled the night before as I was being chased by wolves. As much as Vancouverites often say they hate Torontonians, why? Torontonians really love Vancouver. Our love, of course, begins with the Beachcombers, but for me, it extends to the Vancouver Canucks side stick logo through to the people of Vancouver themselves. Like me, they're very proud to be Canadian. The troupe took the ferry over to Victoria to perform at a theater festival. Victoria is the architectural proof of the saying that there is no one more English than an Englishman who no longer lives in England. Every Englishman who's been there wishes actual England looked like Victoria. We had arrived in the morning, and as it was a festival of the performing arts, I took the time to broaden my horizons and take in a modern dance performance. I was 20, always the youngest in the cast, but the dancers in this troupe were all my age or younger. Beyond the beauty of the girls in the troupe, I was struck by the beauty of modern dance itself. A love affair with dance was born that day, and old Twinkle Toes here silently vowed to himself to try to include dance in everything he would do. Hands down, British Columbia is Canada's most beautiful province. Don't tell Toronto, but when people ask, "Where should I go in Canada?" I say British Columbia. When I got back to Toronto, a Second City touring company castmate, Christopher Ward, had been offered 12 hours a week of television time on a local Toronto station called City TV. City TV had built its reputation by showing pornos on Saturday nights, which they called the Baby Blue Movie. Every Saturday, I Jedi mind-tricked my parents into going to bed so that we could watch the Baby Blue Movie. So it was no surprise when this maverick station, City TV, decided to create Canada's version of MTV with Christopher as its first VJ. Christopher called me up and asked me to be a guest on his show, City Limits, which aired midnight to 6 a.m. on Fridays and Saturdays. I decided to do Wayne Campbell. I would pretend to be Christopher's cousin from Scarborough, who had gotten past security and crashed the show. It was successful. So successful that some Canadian viewers complained that they were letting ruffians from Scarborough on Canadian airwaves. They didn't know Wayne was a character. High praise indeed. Christopher is one of my closest friends. He would go on to write the Alanna Miles smash hit, Black Velvet, and he and I would team up again in Austin Powers with Christopher playing a member of Austin's band, Ming T. It was 1984. I had spent 2 years in the Second City Touring Company, which was the minor leagues of Second City. The main stage company was the Brass Ring, and if you had been in the touring company for as long as I had, without a hint of promotion, it was time to wake up and smell the double-double. You're not getting promoted. So I quit. I was 21, and I had no job and no future prospects in Canada. My friends, the kids in the hall, were coalescing into a cutting-edge sketch comedy troupe, but they weren't hiring. I had made a deal with myself that I would never go to either New York or Los Angeles unless I had a job that required me to go there. Because my parents were English, I could get British citizenship and I could work in England. I had long been a fan of British comedy, Monty Python, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and of course, Peter Sellers. The little voice inside my head said if I didn't move to England now, I never would. So in 1984, I moved to London and left Canada behind. I had no regrets about leaving Canada. I had been lucky enough to work as a professional actor, and I had gotten to see all of the country. I wondered if Canada would still become the next great nation, as had been promised between 1967 and 1976. And although Trudeau was still my prime minister, I'd gotten the sense that the spirit of Confederation, of Expo 67, of the 72 Summit Series, and frankly, of Trudeau Mania itself, had become a thing of the past. I held out hopes that Canada would still, quote-unquote, make it. Nothing was being said to the contrary, it's just that nothing was being said. And even if Canada did become the next great nation, I wouldn't be there to see it. Canada is cold, but England is colder. It's a damp cold that gets into your bones, and you're never quite warm, except if you're in a hot bath, and even then, after 10 minutes in a British hot bath, you find yourself cold in a hot bath. My first 4 months in England were more like an extended vacation, but my Canadian savings were starting to run out, and if I didn't get a job soon, I would have to move back to Toronto with my tail between my legs. One day, I came across a sign in front of the famous Gate Theatre in Notting Hill. Playing at the Gate for the next 3 weeks was a sketch comedy review called Feeling the Benefit. The cast of Feeling the Benefit were all recent alumni of the Cambridge Footlights. Being a student of English comedy, I knew that the Cambridge Footlights was a theater club at Cambridge University, which had put on an annual comedy review since 1883. Past members of the Cambridge Footlights had included my heroes Graham Chapman, John Cleese, and Eric Idle, who went on to form Monty Python. But that was long ago. The cast of Feeling the Benefit was just a group of young, unknown Footlights graduates who were trying to make a name for themselves by putting on this show. The sign also said that the Gate Theatre was hiring people for the box office. So I went upstairs and got a job working the door at the theatre. The next day, I showed up to the Gate Theatre for my training. It became clear that I didn't know British currency. There were half-pence coins, 1 pence coins, 2 pence coins, 5 pence coins, 20 pence coins, 50 pence coins, and 1 pound coins, but also at that time, 1, 5, 10, and 20 pound notes. Also, there was a thing called concessions. Not a concession stand selling food, but ticket price concessions for things like old age pensioners and the unemployed, who needed to show their UB40 unemployment card to get the discounted ticket price. It was the 1980s and Britain had massive unemployment, so most people were on the dole, which meant long delays as I looked at the documents I'd never seen or heard of before. Because of my Canadian accent, my boss assumed that I was mildly delayed. She spoke slowly, over-enunciating, as if I was not only mentally challenged, but deaf as well. As if that weren't bad enough, There was a shortage of chairs at the theater, and so I was forced to sit at the box office table in a prop wheelchair, suffering the unnecessary sympathetic looks of the theater patrons as I invariably got their change wrong. I saw Feeling the Benefit. The cast were all young, confident, good-looking, painfully intelligent, and they spoke with posh accents. It was very funny, very clever, and to my surprise and delight, very loose and silly. They did amazing American accents. At the end of the show, they did a Quinn Martin-type epilogue with a perfect American announcer voice saying something like, "Epilogue. Bill Smith was sentenced to 25 years in a federal penitentiary, which is American for jail." It was hard for me to watch the show because I wanted to be on stage performing instead of working in the box office, making £10 a night, freezing my ass off in the unheated lobby of the theater, sitting in a prop wheelchair and watching other people follow their dreams. The cast was nice. There was one woman in the show, Morwenna Banks, who was fantastic. I would meet her again later in life, when she was briefly on Saturday Night Live. But I now hear Morwenna Banks every day because she's the voice of Mummy Pig in the British children's show Peppa Pig, which my three young children are obsessed with. But I digress. Another cast member Feeling the Benefit stood out, Neil Mullarkey. He was funny, smart, had a great physicality, and he was very likable. There are performers you admire, performers you like, and performers you both like and admire. Neil was a performer I both liked and admired. Over the run of the show, I got to know the cast a little, and from time to time, I was able to make them laugh. After the show, I would sit in my prop wheelchair, cashing out, and as the cast left to get a drink, I would often shout after them, "Great! Walk away! Wish I could!" And then I would roll myself to the top of the stairs and yell down at them, "Must be nice, assholes!" And then, in mock desperation, "Don't leave me!" It would always get a nice laugh. And somehow, it meant more to me that I was getting a laugh from smart English people. But that's just my Canadian low self-image. On the last night of the 3-week run, Neil Mullarkey invited me to join him and the cast for a drink at a pub. I finished cashing out and headed over. Mullarkey asked me how I'd gotten to England, and I told him about Second City. He had heard about Second City and said in his very posh accent, "If you've been a professional comedian at Second City, why on earth would you come to London?" I told him I wanted to be in the land of Python and Peter Sellers. He said that at the moment, there was a booming alternative comedy scene, which meant there were plenty of places to play. I explained to him the Queen Street comedy scene in Toronto, places like the Rivoli, the Beverly Tavern, and the Cameron House. He showed me a copy of Time Out magazine, the magazine that, amongst other things, listed all the comedy venues in London. There were easily 25 places to play. He pointed out that if you got enough material together, you could do 2 shows a night every night. I was amazed. He asked me if I wanted to be in a double act with him. The next day, I quit my job at the Gay Theater. I started to write material with Neil, but I had no idea whether English audiences would like my comedy. I was also unsure of whether I should perform with a Canadian accent or if I should try to adopt an English accent. I could already do Liverpool and Scottish dialects, but that wouldn't match Mullarkey's accent. Using my box office money, I decided I would take 3 elocution lessons at the Central School of Speech and Drama to learn Neil Mullarkey's accent, which is the posh Southern English accent like the Queen's that is called received pronunciation. During the first lesson, we went through the 21 vowel sounds of received pronunciation. Right away, my snobby English speech teacher stopped me and said, "I can't in good conscience take your money." I said, "Why? What's wrong?" He said, "You're never going to learn this. It's your horrible Canadian accent. The monotonous drone, the ridiculous overstressing of final R's, the grotesque diphthong on the vowel sound of the word out. If you spent several lifetimes trying to speak properly, your Canadian nasal twang would fail you every time." I was devastated. But Scarborough kicked in. As I left his office, I said, "Thank you for your time, but may I ask you one small favor?" What? He said curtly. I said, can you please go fuck yourself? I happen to like my Canadian accent. Of course, I didn't say that to him. I wish I had. But I did think it an hour later, while standing on the subway platform. It was a perfect example of the French expression l'esprit d'escalier, which means spirit of the staircase. In France, every building's concierge has a window in the front lobby. As a tired tenant comes home from work, he passes the concierge, who, invariably, says something snarky. Exhausted, the tenant doesn't have a comeback until halfway up the staircase, far too late for a timely rebuttal. Thus, a retort come too late is the product of l'esprit d'escalier. What was all the more alarming to me was that I had actually thought that assimilating into Britain would be a breeze for me. I'm of British heritage. Growing up, I ate English foods, watched English TV shows, watched English soccer, Liverpool, of course. My parents had English accents, with my dad having one of the strongest and most recognizable, the Liverpool accent. But nothing makes you feel more Canadian than moving to Britain. Even more than moving to America, we can, quote-unquote, pass in America, not so in Britain. British culture is so impenetrable that during World War II, even the German spy service, the Abwehr, were unable to successfully infiltrate British society. How, for example, would you make sense of the word Leicester? Would you pronounce it Leicester? Or the last name St. John Stevens? Would you know to pronounce it St. John Stevens? The last name Beauchamp is pronounced Beecham. Ich gebe auf. I surrender. In England, the second you open your mouth, you give away all your private information, rather like Facebook today. Within a few months of living in a West London flat that was so cold you could hang meat in it, it became evident to me that assimilation was impossible and I would have to perform in my, quote-unquote, Canadian nasal twang. So Neil Malarkey and I created material for our imaginatively named double act, Malarkey and Myers. I would be the Canuck, and Neil would be the Limey. The London alternative comedy circuit in the 1980s was a vibrant, cutting-edge, mixed bag of eccentric, experimental, mostly political sketch troupes, singer-songwriters, and stand-up comedians. It was very anti-Thatcher and anti-Reagan, very pro-Labour Party. Hugh Grant started on the alternative comedy circuit, as did the cast of the show The Young Ones, and Jennifer Saunders, known for her role in Absolutely Fabulous. Pretty much, any successful British comedian that you see is likely to have performed at one time on the London alternative comedy circuit. I was Canadian, not terribly political, and the audience I played for while in the Second City Touring Company were genteel by comparison. But I was going to throw my hat into this ring in the form of Malarkey and Myers. That is, if I could get my hat into that ring. It was no small feat. In a weird way, my being Canadian was an asset for breaking into the London alternative comedy circuit. There were rules. Canadians love rules and have a Job-like patience for arcane systems. And London had a system. In order to get a foothold into the London alternative comedy circuit, new acts, like ourselves, had to get booked in one of the smaller venues, usually clubs above pubs, on the outskirts of town. The crowds were small, typically about 90 people. As a newbie, you got the worst slot. You would have to go on first in front of a cold, not yet drunk enough mob. The promoter would only give untested acts like ourselves 5 minutes of stage time, which is not nearly enough time to win over a crowd. And you did all of this for free. If you survived, the promoter asked you back, giving you a 10-minute set, this time for a whopping £10. No venue, large or small, in the center of town would ever deign to meet you until you could show them proof of bookings you had earned in the hinterland. We clipped out all our Malarkey and Myers listings from the back of Time Out and made photocopies, our calling card. Malarkey and Myers' first 10 minutes of material had to be geared to quickly winning over a cold, disinterested, political comedy-loving, America-hating crowd. What we couldn't fix about ourselves, we featured. My Canadian, American-sounding accent was one of them. In our first sketch, I played an over-the-top American character and addressed the audience directly. The British audience did not know what to make of me, but they knew my accent was authentic. I talked just like Americans in movies. If I was English, I was fantastic at dialects. If I was American, they would be charmingly bemused as to why I was on the outskirts of London performing my heart out to 70 hipsters in a room above a pub. We did well, but not always. Sometimes there was nothing you could do to win over an English crowd. Remember, Britain is the home of the soccer hooligan. And British alternative comedy fans didn't just heckle you, they humiliated you. As a Canadian, I didn't know that audiences were capable of humiliating anyone. At Maple Leaf Gardens, if the opposing team scored a clever goal, Leafs fans would give them a polite round of applause. The British pub crowds, on the other hand, wouldn't politely applaud. They wouldn't even just boo you off the stage. They were more creative than that. Sometimes they would hum you off the stage, or sing you off the stage, or sarcastically laugh you off the stage. And one time, I was sarcastically encouraged off the stage, with one prick being particularly adept at telling you exactly what you would have hoped to hear, except he was being completely sarcastic. In a loud, interrupting voice, he would say such haunting things as, "You're doing a great job, Mike! You have a real future in comedy! A star is born! Keep it up, boys!" He got huge laughs. We got crickets. But my hat was off to him. In time, we gathered more material, playing longer sets and inching our way closer to the West End of London. I was making enough money that I didn't have to move back to my parents' house in Canada, which I took as a victory. I called them and told them I was working in a double act with a comedian named Neil Malarkey, to which my dad responded, "What, was Bill Shenanigans not available?" At the end of the conversation, he'd told me he'd had enough of my malarkey. Once we had enough material written, the days were free for me to sightsee. I went to the British Parliament buildings to see how they compared to the Canadian ones. Ours are smaller. Anytime I started to feel homesick, I would go to Canada House in Trafalgar Square. They showed hockey games there. Believe it or not, that's where I was the first time I saw Wayne Gretzky play. It was nice to hang out with Canadians, to hear my own accent, and to talk hockey. I casually mentioned to one of the people who worked at Canada House that I was on the alternative comedy circuit. He asked how I was doing for money. I told the truth. I was getting by, barely. He asked me if I wanted to stuff envelopes there at Canada House. For 2 days' work a week, I could make £75. It was such an insanely generous overpayment, which I later found out was really an elegant way for Canada House to help out struggling Canadian artists in London. I invited the people of Canada House to come see one of my shows, and as it was their mandate to support Canadian artists in Britain, they actually came. Once again, Canadian government to the rescue. In their honor, Neil and I wrote a sketch parodying the movie On the Town. In that musical, Gene Kelly, Jules Munshin, and Frank Sinatra are sailors on shore leave in New York City. To send a special thanks to Canada House, Neil and I played two Mounties on shore leave in London. The third Mountie was played by a life-size standee of a Mountie that we got from Canada House. Part of the fun was trying to have it be an all-singing, all-dancing trio, with one of them being two-dimensional. We changed the lyrics to the song New York, New York. Instead of New York, New York, a wonderful town, we sang, London, England, ain't looking shabby, Tower Bridge, Westminster Abbey, if you get lost, then go ask a babby, London, England, ain't looking shabby. After a while, clubs would call us. Our fees and stage times doubled. We got booked at this massive club called Jongleurs at the Coronet in South London. It went great. They asked us back. Then we got booked at the Comedy Store in Leicester Square. This was the pinnacle. We were doing 9 or 10 shows a week, making the equivalent of $500 a week in cash, which I kept in a shoebox, like a drug dealer. One of the first things I noticed about the alternative comedy circuit in London was that there was very little improvised comedy. There were a few fantastic troupes, but there was no improv comedy scene as there had been in Toronto. It occurred to me that there were very few people teaching improv in London at the time. I decided to supplement my income by teaching a class at the Comedy Store. To my delight and surprise, there was a great deal of interest in improv in the London comedy scene, and my classes were filled to the rafters. Seeing the huge response to the improv classes, the Comedy Store decided to host a weekly improv night. Malarkey and I, and several other comedians, founded the Comedy Store Players, the Comedy Store's in-house improv troupe. The houses were light at first, but steadily grew. This little experiment in improv that I co-founded has been running now for 31 years with the same cast, becoming the longest-running theater show with the same core cast in the history of the English language. It's in the Guinness Book of World Records. By now, Malarkey and Myers had enough material to book a theater at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. The Edinburgh Fringe Festival is an annual summertime performing arts festival. Doing well in Edinburgh puts you into the next tier. Perhaps the BBC would give you a show. We booked a theater and made tons of posters, which we fly-posted everywhere. We did every possible promotional live show, even managed to get on the radio, and someone at the BBC did a filmed piece about us. We needed some deposit money for the theater, and we had 3/4 of it. I approached Canada House, and they got us half of the remaining quarter, and fantastically enough, Ontario House got us the last 1/8. More big government. Hooray! We sold out our 2-week run and got a fantastic review in Time Out magazine. From there, I got hired to do voices for a couple of BBC radio series. I was hired to do a Scottish accent for one of them, and in one of the greatest ironies of my life, BBC Manchester paid for my train ticket from London to Manchester and put me up in a hotel so that I could play a character that had a Liverpool accent in one of their radio shows. I managed to get a London agent, and I got called to audition for an American television movie being shot in London about John Lennon called John and Yoko, A Love Story. It was a small role, a New York Western Union messenger who was so influenced by John Lennon that he dressed exactly like him, granny glasses and all. The scene involved the Western Union messenger giving John Lennon his deportation papers. My agent suggested that I not tell them that I was Canadian, because American producers hated Canadians playing Americans in London productions. The Americans could always sniff out Canadian accents. I decided that I would tell them I was from upstate New York. I met with the director, Sandor Stern. In the room were 20 or so production people. As I read my part, Mr. Stern wrote something on a piece of paper. After I finished my audition, he held up the piece of paper. There was one word on it. B-E-E-N. He said, "Read this." Without thinking, I said, "Bean," using the Canadian pronunciation, not bin, the American pronunciation. "Bean? Do you mean bin? Upstate New York, huh? Where?" he asked. "Way upstate New York, a little town called Toronto, Ontario." The entire production staff burst into laughter. Sandor Stern, the director, said, "It's your lucky day, kid. I'm Canadian. You've got the job." I was working steadily. Malarkey and Myers was continuing to get a following, and the Comedy Store Players were consistently getting full houses. One day, I got a call from a reporter at the Toronto Star. They wanted to do an article about Malarkey and Myers. The angle was that a Canadian comedian was taking London by storm. I was doing okay, but not quite that good. The article came out right before Christmas, and it was a love letter. Thank you, Toronto Star. Coincidentally, I was coming back to Toronto for Christmas. During my phone calls back to Toronto, I began to have suspicions that my father was a little off. My family did not want to upset me, but they had suspicions that he might actually have Alzheimer's. When he picked me up from the airport, I noticed that his driving was off. My dad sold encyclopedias for a living. He had learned how to drive in the British Army, not just cars, but 2.5-ton trucks. He was an expert driver. Something was wrong.